Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:44 p.m. on Thursday, April 4th, 2024. We're meeting in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Geisel, Senator Dunbar, myself, Senator Wilson, Senator Kaufman, and Senator Tobin, our other state business. We are expecting Senator Kaufman at the mid to the end of the committee as he's presented another bill on another committee. We have a couple items on our agenda this afternoon. First, we'll have a confirmation hearing from Dr. Eric Nemo to the State Medical Board. Then we'll have a short presentation on the Governor's Task Force on Child Care. And then we will return to HB 57, Medical Services Review Organization by Rep. Wright. And lastly, we'll continue our discussion on SB 240, School District Medical Assistance by State by the Rules Committee request of the governor. At this time, we have Dr. Nemo on the phone line, not on Teams, and we would like to talk about his qualifications, his credentials, and his reasons for wanting to be on the state, to be confirmed on the state medical board. Dr. Nemo, are you there? If you can place yourself on the record and please begin your invited testimony.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Coming in clearly.
Good. My name is Eric Nemo. I will keep this brief as I presume you all have access to my resume, and there will be time for questions at the end. I was born, raised, and educated in Wisconsin. Started practicing family medicine in a time and a place where family practice was delivering babies, hospital care, critical care, emergency room care, nursing home rounds, most everything. I practiced in small towns in Wisconsin for about 11 years before moving to Alaska in 1998. Again, there I worked in private practice, initially with a small group in Palmer, and then on my own in Wasilla for almost 20 years. I sort of retired from private practice in 2016 and joined the Alaska Department of Corrections. There I worked in Bethel, Fairbanks, Sutton, Anchorage, and Nome. There was also quite a bit of administrative work to be done with the Department of Corrections. I actually retired completely in 2022 and have enjoyed it greatly. However, I have felt all along that I still have something to offer the state of Alaska and the citizens with the years of experience that I have. So when I was approached by one of my colleagues and asked if I would consider serving on the medical board, I began this process. I believe that healthcare should be provided with excellency and should be based on the best evidence that research and experience can provide, and without undue influence from third-party payers, excessive regulation, even popular opinion. I feel that this is the general sentiment of board members I've spoken to, and would like to join them in working toward this. So if there are any questions or if you wish me to expand on anything, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Do we have any questions for Dr. Nemo? Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Nemo, for applying for this position. Have you attended any of the State Medical Board meetings thus far?
I attended one, the last one that happened in February by a Zoom conference.
Senator Geisel.
Great. So what would you identify as the top issues that the State Medical Board is addressing right now?
At the time, the big issue seemed to be about the new PA regulations, but then it turns out that there was going to be legislation regarding this, and everything was tabled until the legislation was done. I have worked with TAs and nurse practitioners in multiple environments, especially when I was with the Department of Corrections.
Senator Giesel?
Thank you. Well, that's very good. Certainly working with nurse practitioners is important. Full disclosure, I am one. But as an aside, what about the issue of our opioid issues? What do you think about the board and addressing those, the rescue medications? What kind of attention would you give on the state medical board to that issue?
I do not know where the state medical board is on that issue right now. I have obviously lived through a lot of that. I watched it develop as there was pressure put on people to prescribe more and more opioids. I watched the other side of that when I was in the Department of Corrections with many people who were suffering from opioid withdrawal, from the criminal effects of it, and the medication-approved treatment that was being started at the time. It's a very difficult problem to deal with.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Nemo, for your answers.
All right. Are there any further questions for Dr. Nemo? Dr. Nemo, where do you see the state medical board, or where would you like the state medical board to focus on in the next five years, tomorrow?
I don't know enough about the state medical board to be into strategic planning. I have just started with them working on applicant approvals and dealing with disciplinary action. I believe that one of the issues we are concerned about is maintaining our ability as healthcare providers in the state of Alaska to do things the way we need to do them in Alaska and not to be influenced too much by what the rest of the country is doing. And I am in favor, as I said, of letting providers make decisions based on their best medical experience and evidence.
Are you still there?
I am still here.
I used to know, it seemed like it was an abrupt cutoff. We didn't know if we got cut off or not. All right. Any further questions? Seeing none. Senator Dunbar, is there a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the appointment of Eric Nemo to the State Medical Board to be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, I just want to thank you for willing to put your name forth and volunteer for the State Medical Board, Dr. Nemo. And we look forward to voting for you in confirmation, or just voting in confirmation, I should say. We'll take a brief at ease, and we'll get ready for our next presentation in the Child Care Task Force. We are back on the record. Next up on our agenda is the Department of Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg with Leah Van Kirk, the Healthcare Policy Advisor from the Department of Health, are here to do a presentation on the Governor's Task Force on Child Care. If you would like to place yourself on the record, you may begin when you're ready.
For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. And yes, with me today, I have Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor. And so the governor issued an administrative order, 346, and we're here today to provide a high-level summary of the work to date on the efforts the task force has taken. The purpose of the task force was to gather representation from across the state of the different child care providers. We do have an ex officio from the Senate, which is Senator Tobin, and Representative Kalum that also sit on the task force. And the intent is to provide recommendations to increase access to quality child care services. We know when we have a robust child care system that it really helps enhance the health of the children. It is also a support to parents to participate in the workforce. And we know that it's an economic driver when we have more workforce. And then finally, it also, when we have a quality child care system, it really prepares those children to enter elementary school. The task force, when we looked at child care actually spans from zero to elementary school. And so for the intent and focus of this task force, we focused on 0 to 6 years old. When we looked at the scant landscape, we actually divided it into 6 topic areas, which is on the slide. During this presentation today, we're going to give you an update on the first 3 areas because that's the task force focus between May 2023 to December 2023 was recommendations around background checks, workforce, and licensing. In total, there are 33 recommendations. I do believe that the committee members have that report, and so we are not going to go into detail, but we're going to give a high-level summary of the work and actions that the department has taken to implementing these recommendations. So, for the first 6 months of the task force, we have had a lot of participation. There has been 14 meetings between May and December. Of those 14 meetings, we had 2 public comment periods that had 26 individuals that called in to provide public comments on the recommendations. And we had 76 individuals that provided written comment. In total, we had about 500 comments on the 33 recommendations. And on the right side of the slide is sort of a list of all of the public comments around the topic area. You'll notice the last 2, collaboration and municipal involvement and zoning challenges, are very specific to local governments. And the other areas is what the state looked at in terms, or the task force made recommendations for the state. So with that, we're going to dive in and provide just a high-level overview of these 5 areas. And I'll start with background checks, and then I'll pass it over to Leah Van Kirk that will provide an update on the remaining 4 areas. So the task force provided 5 recommendations around background checks, and it was really how do we increase access to background checks? And there was a lot of barriers. Several years ago, the department, then Department of Health and Social Services, had a cyber attack that really crippled the infrastructure. And so at that time, there was what is known as a whitelisting that was placed. So child care providers needed to purchase a URL that was secure and then share it with the department so that they could send background check applications to the background check unit. What we heard from child care providers is that it was time consuming and there was a cost to it. And so we took that recommendation and we had a contractor create a secured portal so that child care providers can upload those background check applications directly to the background check unit. So one of those recommendations, it was very easy to address, and it was completed. We've eliminated the whitelisting. The other areas were around increasing access to background checks. There is equipment that's electronic fingerprinting. Right now, it's predominantly paper, and there's equipment called Live Scan. And so in partnership with the Department of Public Safety, we are purchasing 4 Live Scan units. They're going to be deployed out to 4 communities, rural communities, in state office buildings, and we're going to work out the kinks to allow child care providers to come in, have their fingerprints electronically scanned. We'll be able to know if it's a positive scan or if it's an error. Again, that will decrease the time on background checks, and it'll be immediately sent to the background check unit, really moving from a manual process to an automated service. Once we work out those kinks, we do intend to roll this out to other communities. And we do know that there are a lot of other sectors that are looking and clamoring for the same technology. And the intent is very much to open it up to other sectors. We're starting small with 4 communities to make sure that we can work through the processing and staffing for these electronic fingerprinting. Then taking it a step further, there's a lot of rural communities. There's a need for childcare. They have to fly into a hub community to a state building. In partnership with the Office for Children's Services, they actually have mobile devices that they can take out to a community. They can take those electronic fingerprints, and when they come back to the state building, they can upload those fingerprints. And so in partnership, we really want to work with them as they go out to these communities. And when we know there's individuals that want to work in that childcare sector, that they have that opportunity to take advantage of that mobile background check process. So those are the recommendations that were provided by the task force, and that's just a summary to date of where we're at with implementing those recommendations. With that, I will pass it over to Leah, unless there's any questions on background checks.
Yes, I thank you, Commissioner. Background checks, I know that we're talking about the child care task force, but I know a very similar issue for behavioral health providers in order to get sort of be on the white list and getting that dedicated sort of URL. Is this for just for the child care recommendations, or was that be able to implement for others to have a portal? Was that across all sort of the Department of Health, or just for child care facilities?
To the chair, that's a great question. It applies to all sectors.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Great. For the record, Leah Van Kirk, Department of Health. So I'm going to continue moving along the areas that we focused on. And so next was licensing. And licensing is a really important part of ensuring that in Alaska we provide safe and healthy environments for children that offer high quality experiences. And we recognized from public comments, from what we were hearing from providers, that there are some needs to help build a more robust licensing system. So we focused on building technical assistance and removing barriers. So one of the areas that was identified that's very similar to some of the background check issues is that technology needed to help support the process being more efficient. And so actually, since the start of the governor's task force, we've been able to procure a new technology system for the child care program office that is scheduled to launch in October 2024. And that system actually will have 3 components to it that provides portals for providers, families, and state and grantee staff. It will allow providers to submit licensing applications on web-based forms to check the status of their license, to see if there's anything that they need to complete and return. And it also alerts staff at the Child Care Program Office that something has been submitted. So moving forms and that process through technology, I think, is going to increase efficiencies. We're excited about being able to work on that as well. One of the areas identified also was that the licensing process can be cumbersome. It takes time, dedication. There might be different municipal requirements that need to be met. And so coaching and navigation was identified as an important component to provide people as they work through the licensing process. We also identified that we wanted to replicate things that we know work in Alaska. And so in the South Kenai Peninsula, the Division of Public Health, the Healthy and Equitable Communities Program, has worked with child care providers and the child care program office, and in less than 1 year, they increased the available child care slots from 55 to 150. And so we know that there are areas of the state that are doing excellent work in really building on and building out the child care sector. So we want to make sure we utilize those lessons. We also want to focus on creating materials for businesses and for people who are interested in starting a child care business in order to support the licensing process. We have those resources available, and so we need to share those more widely as people are examining how to start a child care business. I'm going to go ahead and move into workforce unless there are any questions regarding licensing. Okay, great.
Well, I, for the record, just want to note that we were joined a minute ago by Sandra Kaufman.
Thank you. So when we talk about workforce, I think we have certainly heard and know that we have workforce challenges in the early childhood education system across the state. And so one of the main goals of the Child Care Task Force was to focus on elevating a professionally paid and supported workforce, ensuring access to benefits, professional development, and also building out pathways to advancement. And so one of the interesting things that people learned as part of the presentations is that for instance, at the University of Alaska Anchorage, they have increased the available degree programs and occupational endorsement programs for early childhood education, and they've seen a huge increase in enrollment. And so I think what's really important to know is that Alaskans are interested in being part of the early childhood education workforce. We conducted a workforce study, and actually 93% of people in the early childhood education workforce plan to stay in that workforce and want that to be their career. This leads us to really understanding, how do we keep people within the workforce in early childhood education? And so there's been a compilation of studies. We had a workforce study that we conducted as part of the Governor's Task Force that was building upon the Johns Hopkins University study in 2019 that looked at Alaska's early childhood education workforce. Also the first children's finance report, as well as our early childhood strategic plan. All of these studies really point to the recommendations that are outlined in the Governor's Task Force report, focusing on increasing wages, increasing access to benefits, supporting healthy workplace conditions, strengthening career pathways, providing additional support to in-home providers. We actually saw a higher turnover rate in in-home providers compared to people working in a licensed childcare center. So that support for in-home childcare providers is important. And then also improving system coordination and accountability. So I like to talk about our technology advancements and looking forward to October, how that communication between providers and our childcare program office staff is going to be enhanced. So with that, I can stop and answer questions, or I can move on to employers and how they play a role as well.
Please continue.
Okay. So one important area that we focused on is employer-based childcare. And this came up because Alaska is recognizing the need for a healthy and robust workforce throughout the state, not just in early childhood education. And so employers are reaching out to the department and saying, how can we help? How can we support a workforce? And so it really is focusing on this public-private partnership and taking a look at how employers can play a role in advancing and increasing access to childcare. So some of those recommendations have been around evaluating current space that we might have available in school district buildings, in state buildings, and public buildings. Also, looking at how we can support employers in building out on-site or near-site childcare within their businesses or near their businesses. We had a few presenters come from different businesses who have incorporated this, and they report that they have had really excellent retention of employees, higher paid workforce, and it has been a model that hospitals are increasingly using as well as other businesses. We also talked about the importance of tax credits for employers who are supporting childcare or supporting stipends for childcare. SB 237 was introduced, the Alaska Affordability Act, to address what some of those tax credits could do to support employers who want to support the childcare workforce. And all of these things, I think, have been a catalyst to set in motion engagement from the private sector and from businesses across Alaska. I can pause there before I move into...
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions on that last point. So, you know, we have relatively few organizations in the state that pay a significant amount of taxes, right? I mean, we're a low-tax state, essentially. So you mentioned hospitals, for example, you know, large oil companies, that kind of thing. We have pretty intense competition for employees right now. Was there any concern that this is a benefit that these large companies can offer? It's great. We want them to offer it. But will it allow them to sort of outcompete small businesses? Is there some way for small businesses to pool? Or how would a business, how would a fishing boat take advantage of this kind of tax credit, for example?
So for the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. So the governor's bill, Senate Bill 237, that's in play. I would defer all of those questions to the Department of Revenue because I think it's for a specific type of tax credit to a specific business sector. I think you raise really good points around small businesses. And that was one of the recommendations from the task force, is to have an employee that's focused on working with the business sector, whether it's small all the way to large, to figure out how to pull the resources together in order to support that business need for the workers and their children. I think this also dovetails into some of the remaining ARPA funding that we received, about $14 million, we gave out through community grants. One of those pilot projects was actually in Anchorage and is co-opting. So it's four organizations coming together and working together on the staffing model to support childcare for those employees. So I think there's a lot, there is tax credits, which was a recommendation, but there's also a lot of other factors that we're looking at on how to partner with businesses as they're looking at on-site or near-site childcare for their employees.
And yes, and Senator Dunbar, just as a reminder, the Department of Revenue will be here next Thursday for another bill with similar tax credits for questions. But please continue.
Yeah, and so similar efforts at the Muni level when I was there to use ARPA funds and CARES Act funds to directly subsidize child care providers. So I guess my question is, why take the tax credit model versus, because either way you're going to lose revenue, why not collect the revenue and then just directly set up these kind of programs that any business could buy into? If you wanted them to have skin in the game, they could pay to join, you see what I'm saying? And then any small business could do it, as opposed to favoring these very large corporate taxpayers.
I guess to reframe it, can we do a sharp four for childcare providers?
So to the chair, sharp four, it's something that we did actually evaluate to see if we could use the loan reimbursement program to support the child care sector. I think the short answer was no. To your question, Senator Dunbar, I think all options are on the table. I think we're looking at everything that we can do to support the child care sector. And I think these are all of the ongoing conversations that we have right now.
Kind of a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. What in other states, how has this played out? Now, it's a little bit difficult because we're the only state in the country without a broad-based tax. So, comparatively low corporate taxes and other tax revenues. But in other states, I went to the District of Columbia this past summer, and they have universal pre-K now. Pre-K is a little different than childcare, but, you know, some similar goals. You know, it's not a tax credit system. They just pay for it. Why not just do that? Or let me reframe. What has happened in states with those two different models, directly paying for it versus a tax credit system?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, One of the areas that we're going to be examining moving forward and prior to our final report is access and affordability. And so those conversations are on the table right now within the governor's task force. One that I would highlight is the tri-share model. And so we have met with Michigan and Kentucky, and that's a model where employers can opt in and pay a portion of a childcare cost. And so it typically would mean, you know, tri-share. So an employer pays a third, the parent pays a third, and then the state would pay the other third. And so we're absolutely examining other models because we have to approach the childcare sector and the barriers that we see incrementally and from many different viewpoints, especially when it comes to thinking about moving forward. Our next steps are talking about subsidies. Senator Wilson asked a great question about the payer mix. And when we look at the payer mix, only about 20 to 30% of children attending childcare are utilizing a subsidy. And so we have 70 to 80% of other families and children who are utilizing childcare. And so making sure that we're looking at this through the lens of the childcare sector as a whole and having many different options that are going to support families that are eligible for subsidy, families that are not, employers who are large and can benefit from a tax credit, or the small fishing boat. So I hope that answers your questions and be happy to answer any follow-up.
Thank you. I just noticed the next slide is basically all about this, so thank you.
Please continue.
Sure. So one at the end here that I wanted to talk about was tribal authority. So one of the things that we recognized right away was that that the Administration for Children and Families, the federal oversight agency, provides oversight to states and to tribes. And so their federal oversight has all of the same health and safety requirements and standards. And so right now, the governor's task force made a recommendation that we allow the federal oversight to be the oversight agency and exempt them from state oversight additionally. So it removes that duplicate oversight. And this is very similar to how military childcare facilities operate. Their oversight is the Department of Defense. They're exempt from state licensing requirements. And so we were aligning tribal authority and federal oversight with tribal childcare facilities as well. All right. So moving forward, we are examining subsidies, access and affordability, and quality. And these are the areas that we're going to be making recommendations for our final report. And you can see it on the slide there. We note some of the models used in other states to share the cost of care. And as I noted before, I think that's an important component of this because one answer and one recommendation or one way to approach isn't going to meet the need of the entire childcare sector. I'm going to spend just a moment talking about subsidies. We are looking at subsidies, and there are three levers that impact federal funding and how we use those federal funds in subsidies. And that is the state median income that a family qualifies for, so their eligibility. There's also a copay, so the percentage that a family pays, as well as the state rate. And so we've heard, as we've talked about childcare, the market price survey versus the cost of care survey, and utilizing each of those to set our state rate. We currently use the market price survey, and we are currently conducting a cost of care survey. The difference between those two surveys is that a market price looks at what are providers charging right now for childcare. And at the 75th percentile is where the state rate is set. A cost of care survey is really evaluating what the costs are and the geographical differences in cost. That cost of care study will be complete in July. We're on the tail end of our market price survey now. So we're looking forward to utilizing that information to inform our efforts moving forward. I also want to spend some time talking about quality and the importance of quality across all early childhood education systems. That includes Head Start, pre-K, childcare. And right now in our state, we have a system that we implemented in 2016 called Learn and Grow. And it serves all three of those sectors that I just mentioned, provides coaching and stipends, and really focuses on how we build quality to support children to make sure that they're ready for school, that their health needs are met, their behavioral health needs are met. And so we have heard an increase in need for early, the infant and early mental health of children has been a significant impact and stressor on the workforce. And so that's why we called out increasing access for children with special needs and supporting children's behavioral health as part of this work moving forward. So I'll stop there and pause for questions, and thank you for the opportunity to present.
All right. Any final questions for our presenters on the Child Care Task Force? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned Head Start. What was their sort of, what's their role in all of this? Is one of the recommendations of the task force to increase access to Head Start?
So through the chair to Senator Dunbar, no, the recommendation wasn't directly to Head Start. The Department of Education provides the oversight for Head Start. However, when we look at early childhood education as a whole and improving quality systems, many times Head Starts are also providing childcare. And so we want to make sure that we're aligned across systems so that we're implementing quality wherever a child might be. So the way those intersect for us is through building out what quality early childhood education looks like and making sure that we're aligned in each of those programs and can provide that support to all of those programs.
Brief follow, Mr. Chair. So alignment and quality, I see the role of the department and why you'd want that. But for the average person, they need someone to, you know, both take care of and educate their child for a period of the day, right? And a lot of them use Head Start. A lot of them in my district, at least. Head Start is widely utilized. So you've talked about access and affordability. That seems like a program that is functioning well. Would you say it would be a good or bad thing for their overall system if there were more functioning Head Start classrooms?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I think that providing high quality programming that's affordable to parents is good, no matter what it's called or what the oversight agency is. And I hope that answers your question. I certainly know working together as a sector, as a system, is important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We just want to say thank you again for providing this presentation. And we look forward to having a little bit more conversation on child care next week with the next bill that's up. We'll take a brief at ease as we transition to House Bill 57. We are back on the record. We'll now return to our conversation at HB 57, Emergency Medical Services Review Organizations, by Representative Wright. We held an initial hearing on this bill on March 14th, including the introduction in the bill, a sexual analysis, invited, and public testimony for the bill. We have Rep. Wright and his trustee staff, Rachel Gunn, here available to just give us a quick overview of what this piece of legislation does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Wright. For the record, House Bill 57 introduces legal protections for confidential EMS peer reviews and quality assurance discussions, fostering an environment of continuous learning and safety. It shields EMS providers from medical directors, from legal repercussions, ensuring that they focus on improving patients' care without fear.
Thank you. And we also have Todd McDowell from the Department of Health, from EMS System Manager on the phone, available for questions. And are there questions from the bill sponsor before we move to amendments? Seeing none. Thank you, guys. You might just hang out there for a quick moment. At this time, I'd like to move the adoption of Amendment Number 1, Version A3.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have an objection to Amendment Number 1. Amendment Number 1 addresses price transparency and the disclosure of healthcare cost information for healthcare providers. We updated our laws in 2018. Since that time, our federal laws have been updated twice, I believe, with the ACA Act and the No Surprise Billing Act, which are now a little bit more rigorous than our own state laws. Amendment Number 1 provides statutory clarity upon those laws. If passed, hospitals would be subject to compliant with the federal requirements in 45 CFR 180 and would also have to be compliant with the state standards found in AS 1823-400. If the CFR 180 or other similar federal hospital transparency regulations are repealed, hospitals would need to comply with the state reporting requirements. So we're not getting rid of those state reporting requirements. We're just saying if those federal, higher stringent federal requirements are repealed, then that reverts back to our state requirements currently in law. This retains and preserves price transparency, but avoids two set of reporting requirements for hospitals. Federal requirements are, again, a little bit more stringent to our own state requirements. And there are four items that were given to members in their packets that are related from the Alaska Hospital Healthcare Association, the Alaska Regional Hospital, and Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. And we also have folks online to answer questions if they want a little bit more of practicality of how this amendment would work or how the current practices are. We have Jared Kosen, the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital Healthcare Association. We have Jennifer House, a finance director of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. And we have Anna Himmerson, from the chief financial officer from the South Peninsula Hospital, if members would like to have a little bit more detail of the practicality of what's happening now and why they feel this amendment would be beneficial to those healthcare organizations. Questions? Senator Geisel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly understand that we would, I see the efficacy of this. I'm having trouble figuring out how that connects to emergency medical services reviews. This feels like a whole new topic, perhaps another bill that's being imported. I need some clarification.
Not another bill, just amendment to the similar sections of law and statutes that this current bill touches currently already.
Yes, I can see that. Yes, thank you. I noted that.
I think that's the premise, is that this is a statute, opens the same statutes to do a quick legislative fix. And we also have a prepared title change resolution as well.
Another question, follow-up,
yes,
please.
Senator Geisel.
So I would be interested in the bill sponsor's response to this significant amendment.
Representative Wright.
Thank you. Representative Wright, for the record. I have had an opportunity to take a look at the amendment, and I think if I have an opportunity to do some good somewhere else in a similar manner of the legislation, I would be happy to take on that as well.
Any other questions? Maybe we can, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note, both for the record and as a note of appreciation to the chair, the form of this amendment as I'm reading it now. Oh, that's actually the old version. Here it is, A3. Provides, I believe, a backstop here. So the language is interesting, right? And I understand it's a little bit clunky, because what we're trying to accomplish here is that the hospitals will be held to this higher federal standard. And so 45 CFR 180, as it reads at the effective date of the act, or another federal price transparency requirement that is reasonably similar, assuming there's a change in the CFR. I think what we're going for here is that the hospitals will be held to at least the same height of standard. If, because of the way the amendment is structured, if for some reason the federal law were fully repealed, it would revert back to the state standard. So the state standard is a backstop, a fallback, if the federal law was repealed. And so I just want to say that's how I read this amendment. Future lawyers that might be listening to this, I hope that's how you read this amendment. I appreciate the chair's efforts in crafting it that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there further discussion, or anyone like Senator? All right, Senator Kaufman.
No, I have no issue. I was just adjusting them.
Oh, okay. All right. With that, is the, for the record, I'd like to hear from maybe we can ask Mr. Kosin, the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospitals Healthcare Association, just to provide a little comment and background on why, sort of the impetus of this amendment and some of the difficulties that our Alaskan hospitals face now with the dueling statutes, federal and state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jared Kosin. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. And to provide the background you're talking about, and I know you hit some of these points, and I'll enhance them a little bit, but in 2018, Alaska updated its laws concerning the disclosure of healthcare cost information from a variety of provider types. And this is what we call price transparency. This is a good policy. This is a policy we fully support. But since then, the federal government has significantly invested its attention and resources on price transparency and its own requirements for hospitals specifically. And the federal requirements are in many ways decades ahead of where our state standards are. And just to give kind of a couple examples, the state requires hospitals to compile a list of standard charges for 10 of the most commonly performed services over the previous year, over six categories. So that creates a list of 60 charges in a PDF document. The federal rules also require us to compile a list of standard charges, but the list covers at least 300 shoppable services, and it provides five different types of charges. So as you can imagine, five different types of charges for 300 services versus a list of 60 in a PDF document. Additionally, the federal rules require this information to be published in machine-readable files, which is a huge deal because this is kind of the future and the concept of creating a mechanism so consumers can shop transparently for healthcare services. Ultimately, the problem we have, as you highlighted, Mr. Chair, is the state requirements can only be achieved by manually pulling data and manually constructing a report that is then locked into a PDF. This same information is already produced at a much greater scale for the federal requirements. So making it clear that we at the hospital should follow those federal standards will not only save time and resources for hospitals and financial teams, but it's also going to save time and resources for the state and the state employees who manage the program. So we really appreciate the committee considering this issue and bringing this clarity to avoid this kind of dual compliance problem. And we agree with Senator Dunbar that we appreciate this amendment in particular because it really gives assurances that if the federal requirements ever fall below the standards set forth by the state, hospitals will no longer meet that definition that is allowing them to be excluded, and we'd automatically fall back to the state standard. So this is not an attempt to get out of anything. It's an attempt to streamline what we're already doing. And in closing on these remarks, I would offer the fact that the federal requirements focused on shoppable services is such an important piece, because in the state report, while it's laudable to try and pull the most commonly performed services, so often those services are little pieces of larger episodes of care, like a surgery. When you look at it at the shoppable level, you're actually getting at the full episode of care, whether it be a surgery or some other type of procedure. So it really becomes information that can be used by the consumer, where the state requirements don't really kind of hit that mark. So I'll pause there. I'm happy to answer any questions and appreciate the committee considering this issue.
Are there any questions for Mr. Cosen? Seeing none, just want to say thank you for being available and online to help explain this issue in a little bit more detail. Seeing that, is the objection or the further conversation on the amendment? Objection maintained?
Chair Wilson, I remove my objection.
Is there further objection to adoption of Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 passes. That brings the bill back before us as amended. Representative Wright, do you have any closing remarks?
I'd just like to thank the committee for bringing this legislation forward again and hearing it, and I really do appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. And what is the will of the committee, Senator Kaufman?
I have a motion. I move HB 57 version 33-LS0335/A as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
All right. Is there objection?
Subject for purpose of discussion.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
You mentioned a title change.
Yes, that comes on to the floor. After the bill is passed, then legal will provide a title change resolution that will be given to be read across and most likely sit on the secretary's desk until this piece of legislation is taken up.
Okay. That's normally how that works. Thank you. I remove my objection.
Right. Is there a further objection? Seeing none. House Bill 57 moves from committee with attached or zero physical note and with the individual recommendations. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, our last item of business before us is Senate Bill 240, School District Medical Assistance, by Senate Rules at the request of the governor. We initially heard and took public and invited testimony on this bill on February 27th. At a second hearing on March 12th, we adopted an amendment that lowered the age of consent for Medicaid services to 18 to 16. We did not receive further amendments at that time. We were asking the department to provide some comments upon the that amendment on if certain items and questions that we sent to the department. I distribute the questions to members. And just sort of asking how this would happen in terms of payment and insurance and those questions, and we got the answer back from the department. And so we are I don't have further questions from the bill sponsor. I guess we should ask the representative, Ms. Van Kirk, just to quickly just give an overview of this piece of legislation on what this bill currently does. So just to remind committee members and folks listening at home what SB 240 does.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. For the record, my name is Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. So SB 240 removes the requirement that a child be a child with a disability or have an individualized education plan in order for school districts to submit claims for reimbursement to Medicaid. And so this really focuses on allowing services to be provided to children in schools regardless of their status related to special education or any type of diagnoses.
All right, thank you. Are there questions from the bill sponsor for the bill? And I'll just quickly state the concern and the response that we got back. And my, you know, was about parental consent for billing for services and wondering if Medicaid would need to have that same consent. And it's sort of from the department's viewpoint that because of FERPA and other issues that we still probably most likely wouldn't need parental consent for folks for billable services unless a provider would like to volunteer those services. And so seems like we still need parental consent, so I'm fine with the bill as amended. And if there's further conversation?
No further conversation, Chair Wilson. We just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill.
All right. And just looking to see if there's a motion or will of the committee. Senator Kaufman.
I move Senate Bill 240, version 33, GS2369/A, as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And I'll object because I also forgot to mention that we did include, I was on a webinar the other day about child care, Medicaid, health care in schools, and we provided sort of from the Georgetown University of sort of a document that talks about Medicaid utilization in school districts. And I just found that as a useful piece of information, and we upload that on basis if people want to refer to that for future hearings, as well as the bill continues to move throughout this building. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing none. House Bill 57, I'm sorry, Senate Bill 240, previous bill, moves as amended from committee with attached physical notes and individual recommendations. That concludes our business. We'll go ahead and pass that around. So there is no meeting on Tuesday, April 9th, and we'll send information on the information on Thursday as we get that further meeting confirmed. Are there members' closing comments? Seeing none, please stick around to sign the form. We are adjourned at 2:43 p.m.